I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. New Defense Secretary Robert Gates had another get-to-know-you breakfast with U.S. troops in Baghdad today. Gates said he wasn't surprised that the soldiers asked for more troops to secure the volatile country. He also doesn't think there's much disagreement about an increase in U.S. troops among Iraqi leaders. But U.S. military leaders reportedly are split on that idea, while the White House seems to be leaning toward a temporary surge. Well, Veterans Affairs Secretary Jim Nicholson raised a few eyebrows yesterday by saying society would benefit if the U.S. were to bring back the draft. Later, though, he issued a statement saying he does not support reinstituting one. But the Selective Service System is making plans to test the draft system in 2009. Joining us on the line from the Selective Service System office in Arlington, Virginia, is spokesman Dick Flahaven. Hello.
Hi.
So President Bush and several members of Congress have said they do not want to institute the draft. The White House says there's no proposal on the table for that at all. So why test the system?
Well, we've tested our system ever since we've been in business, since 1980. And it's just a periodic exercise that we go through to make sure that our plans and procedures and our automation support are all in sync and actually will operate the way we intended to.
The president said in his news conference this week that he's inclined to increase the size of the military. And because of recruiting problems, the armed forces actually apparently have accepted recruits with lower aptitude test scores at times. So now when we hear talk of a test of the draft system, even if it's something that you've done since 1980, it makes people nervous. What would you say to them?
Well, there is, in fact, no urgency or no immediate desire to bring back the draft. And this is supported by a couple of things. One is both the president and the former Secretary of Defense have indicated there's no military necessity for a draft. Number two, Selective Service is not funded and resourced to run a draft today. And thirdly, there's no political sentiment on the Hill to pass legislation authorizing the draft.
If you did have to crank up the system, could you do so in a relatively short period of time?
Our task is to provide the first young man to the military 193 days after we are told to turn the system on. And then 30 days beyond that, we should have sent the Department of Defense 100,000 individuals. So that is what we plan for, that is our task, and that is what we are prepared to do when directed.
Essentially, then, this test really is looking at your system overall and is sort of a simulation of what you would do, what kind of numbers you might have, and what you might do with different categories of folks, say conscientious objectors or people like that.
Exactly. So it would be transparent to the public, and it would be all done internally by Selective Service, and it'd all be simulated. We wouldn't be calling any young men. Nobody would be involved other than Selective Service staff.
When was the last test?
We had a test back in 1998. We used to be on a more rigorous schedule. In other words, about every 3 years we'd run a test. But over the last decade, based upon change in personnel, reductions in personnel, we haven't conducted one since 98.
So what we're talking about here, if this test of the Selective Service System happens, as you're planning right now, is it's a test and only a test.
It's only a test. Doesn't involve any young men. It would strictly be transparent to anybody outside of Selective Service.
You know, I still think, though, that there are people who are saying if the last one was in 98, and this is a particularly touchy time when we're talking about the U.S. military, why do it right now?
Well, it's just a aspect of being ready. Obviously, if you have programs, you want to make sure they would, in fact, operate the way you've designed them. That's one reason. And secondly, you do have changes in automation and the privacy concerns and whatnot, and that's the kind of thing you want to update and make sure you've got covered whenever you do any kind of an evaluation of your programs.
Dick Flahaven is a spokesman for the Selective Service System. And now to some old-fashioned escapism. Tis the season for Hollywood's newest blockbusters to hit theaters, and this year promises several new releases to please the couch potato crowd as well. The shopping is over, the dishes are done, and there's a whole new slew of DVDs to curl up with. To help us sort through them is Janine Basinger. She's chair of the Film Studies Department at Wesleyan University. She's also the curator of the Frank Capra, Ingrid Bergman, and Clint Eastwood Film Archives, among others. And she joins us from the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Janine, a frequent bonus of DVD collections is the accompanying retrospective on the featured actor or director. And you are a featured speaker in two collections that we're going to be talking about today, Gary Cooper, the Signature Collection, and the premier Frank Capra Collection. We're going to talk about those in a couple of minutes. But first, let's start with a few sets that are made for wide appeal.
Who are you?
Bond. James Bond.
That's Sean Connery from 1964, Goldfinger. Four new volumes of 007 in the James Bond Ultimate Edition. What have we got here, Janine?
Well, it's wonderful entertainment, you know. From 1962 to 2006, they've endured. These are fun. They're supposed to be fun. Let's not get crazy about attitudes toward women or strange politics or possibly politically incorrect villains. Let's just have fun. Just put your feet up and say, okay, fast cars, beautiful women, good-looking guys, great locations, let's go for it.
Okay, so who's the best Bond?
Well, I, of course, am an old-fashioned person, so naturally for me, the best Bond is Sean Connery because he was the Bond that defined the series.
So how about, Daniel Craig as the new Bond in the new Casino Royale?
He's a really good Bond. He's a different Bond. He's a Bond that can be broken, you know? He gets all scratched up and bloodied and beaten and torn and wrecked, but he keeps going. He's very handsome, and he does his action sequences very well, and he's a very good actor. So I thought that despite the fact everybody thought he was going to be no good, he was a really good Bond.
You've just finished a book on Hollywood's star system. Two of the biggest stars in the 60s, obviously, were the on- and off-screen couple Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. And one of their very well-known films was Mike Nichols' adaptation of Edward Albee's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Why don't you want to kiss me?
Well, dear, if I kissed you, I'd get all excited. I'd get beside myself, and then I'd have to take you by force right here on the living room rug. And our little guests would walk in, and, well, what would your father say about that?
Oh, you pig.
Oink, oink.
Fix me another drink, lover.
My God, you can sweat it down, can't you?
Look, sweetheart, I can drink you under any goddamn table you want, so don't worry about me.
I gave you the prize years ago, Martha. There isn't an abomination award going that you haven't won. And just stay on your feet, that's all. These people are your guests.
I can't even see you.
Did you pass
out? I haven't been able to see you for years.
I try to keep your clothes on, too. There aren't many more sickening sights in this world than you with a couple of drinks and your skirt up over your head.
A zero.
Your heads, I should say.
Janine, why do you think America is so fascinated with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton?
Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton are the couple that emerged in the spotlight right at the time that the barriers went down on protecting movie stars, when the old studio system had kind of collapsed, and the system that hid their peccadilloes from the public and kind of kept them off in a corner and covered up for them went away, and the paparazzi emerged, and everything any star couple did was front page news, and I mean everything. And Elizabeth Taylor was the big star of that era. A star that the public had grown up with, had seen her start as a little child and go forward, stunningly gorgeous, everybody's idea of what a movie star was. And then she married a British actor, taking him away from his wife. I mean, it's the stuff that tabloids thrive on. It's just something fascinating. I mean, you're getting drama from her off screen that is better than the drama you're getting from her on screen. And they had the money and the prestige and the celebrity power to do anything they wanted. And so people watched, what will they do with it? And sadly, what they did wasn't always of the quality of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
You are a featured speaker on the DVD set, Gary Cooper, The Signature Collection. Remind us where he fits in terms of film history.
Gary Cooper is one of the greatest male movie stars in film history. He was a top box office star for more than a decade. He's a double Oscar winner. He won Best Actor for Sergeant York and also for High Noon. He could do comedy. He could do drama. He could do westerns. He could do adventure films. And he was also famous for playing real Americans in biographical films like Sergeant York, or he played Lou Gehrig in Pride of the Yankees. And he's a beautiful man, a tall, rangy, natural actor with a great deal of style. He's one of my favorites.
You mentioned Sergeant York, and that was based on the true story of Alvin C. York, who was a farmer from Tennessee, drafted in World War I, and he had a change of heart. Even though he had been a pacifist, he became a sharpshooter and a hero. We're going to hear scenes. It's a pivotal scene, and here's Gary Cooper playing Sergeant York with his commanding officer, who's played by Stanley Bridges.
Well, I don't want to be no corporal.
What's that?
I said I don't want to be no corporal.
Why not?
You wait a minute, Captain. Let him talk.
Well, you see, I...
Is it because of your religious convictions, York?
Yes, sir. That's it. You see, I believe in the Bible. And I'm believing that this here life we're living is something the Lord done give us. And we got to be living it the best we can. And I'm figuring that the killing other folks ain't no part of what he was intending for us to be a-doing here.
Well, yes, in a way, I agree with you.
His story was a perfect metaphor because it put to the average American person, why do we fight wars? And when we do and you're called, why should you go? What does it mean? And particularly if it is against your religion, where does your duty lie between God and country? This movie was released at the beginning of World War II, on the brink of World War II, and this was an issue that was very much on people's minds. And so this film put it right up on the screen, and it is clearly articulated in this scene.
Janine Basinger is chair of the Film Studies Department at Wesleyan University in Connecticut. Don't go away. We'll be back with suggestions for a couch potato holiday movie festival with new collections by two of Hollywood's favorite directors and some risque movies made before the censors clamped down. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. We're back with Janine Basinger, chair of the Film Studies Department at Wesleyan University. She's helping us sort through the new DVD releases and find the best movies to curl up with over the holiday break. There are too many re-releases of classics for us to get to all of them today, but there are a few from highly respected directors. From Frank Capra comes the premier Frank Capra Collection, with all the hits from Mr. Smith Goes to Washington to It Happened One Night. We have a clip from American Madness. In this scene, the Union National Bank has just been robbed, and rumors about the bank's solvency spread quickly.
What bank did you say that
Union
was?
Union National Bank.
Broke. Haven't got a dime. Listen, Jack, you better go down to the Union National Bank and take your money out of there. Don't ask me how I know. I tell you it's on the rocks. And they got any friends, you better tell them, too.
You better give all the men in your plant a couple of hours off to get their money out.
Tell Mrs. Hardy to tell everybody in the apartment house.
All right, I'll get it or bust a few noses.
Holy smoke, I'll get right down there if I have to fly.
Run down there and get your money at once.
Number one, shooting to the guilt. The bank is talking for one.
Hello, the whole fight is Chicago Hong Kong, too, little.
Hello, dear. Listen, have you heard the news?
Oh, please hurry. Just now.
Janine Basinger, you knew Frank Capra very well.
Yes.
What was he trying to get at in his films, do you think?
Frank wanted to entertain. The main thing about any Frank Capra movie is he never forgot the audience. He's a master filmmaker. This montage is rapid. It's engaging and involving. It reveals action and different character involvement at a great pace with enormous clarity to the viewer. And it's a kind of prototype for what he's going to do later in the post-war period in the run on the Savings and Loan Company and his more famous film, It's a Wonderful Life. You know, when you're looking at films that are 70 years old and you see how times have changed from the 30s to today, and you realize that this work can stand the test of time, that you can sit down and see it happen one night and laugh at it and enjoy it the same way that the audiences did in 1934, it's a pretty remarkable thing. And these films really do the job. And that's what Frank was after. Wherever he is, he's a happy man.
Also, there's a collection out from the almost cultish director, Preston Sturges. There's a set of 7 films, including his famous comedies. What do you think of this particular collection?
I absolutely recommend the Preston Sturges collection. First of all, I worship Preston Sturges. He is one of the greats of American film. He is one of the funniest writers ever, and he directs with a free-balling, wild pace that just knocks you off your seat. His films have an astonishing mixture of really slapstick, low-action physical comedy and the highest level of sophistication in the writing and the performing. They're just wonderful. This collection contains the first movie he ever directed, The Great McGinty. Sturges had been a screenwriter, and he was never happy with the way people directed his screenplays. He allegedly told Paramount Pictures he'd give them this for a dollar if they'd let him direct it. So they did let him direct, and it was an unexpected hit, and it launched his career as a director of a series of just wonderful comedies full of hilarious oddball characters doing unexpected things and speaking some of the most amazingly witty dialogue you could possibly hear in the movies.
Here's a scene that illustrates the idealistic filmmaker, played here by Joel McRae in Sullivan's Travels from 1941.
I want this picture to be a commentary on modern conditions, stark realism, the problems that confront the average man.
But with a little six.
A little, but I don't want to stress it. I want this picture to be a document. I want to hold a mirror up to life. I want this to be a picture of dignity, a true canvas of the suffering of humanity.
But with a little six.
With a little sex in it.
How about a nice musical?
How can you talk about musicals at a time like this, with the world committing suicide, with corpses piling up in the street, with grim death gargling at you from every corner, with people slaughtered like sheep?
Maybe they'd like to forget that.
Then why do they hold this one over for a fifth week at the music hall? For the ushers?
It died in Pittsburgh.
Like a dog.
What do they know in Pittsburgh?
They know what they like.
If they knew what they like, they wouldn't live in Pittsburgh. That's no argument.
You chose another set, too, the Forbidden Hollywood Collection. That's a 2-disc box set that includes 3 films that were made before Hollywood started enforcing the production code of 1934. Why do you like this set?
I really like these movies. They're rough. They're tough. They're low down and they're gritty. And also, they're important, I think, for people to see, because people do have oversimplified ideas about Hollywood movies. These are pre-code enforcement movies. The women are prostitutes. They're willing to do anything. There's no fixing it up about it. These movies are, they've got the sordid side of life right up on the screen in a very frank way. And most people don't realize that Hollywood made films like this. It's also true that they are vehicles for 3 great stars: Babyface, Barbara Stanwyck, redheaded woman Jean Harlow, and the lesser known Mae Clark in the early version of Waterloo Bridge. Mae Clark is famous for being the woman that Jimmy Cagney stuck the grapefruit in her face, you know, in Public Enemy. But she was a very good actress, and she's excellent in this film.
Well, thanks very much for speaking with us.
You're very welcome. It was my pleasure.
Janine Basinger is chair of the Film Studies Department at Wesleyan University. Her new book, The Star Machine, comes out in 2007. Okay, we can't resist. What would a holiday season be without the transformation of George Bailey from Frank Capra's classic It's a Wonderful Life?
Look, Daddy, teacher says every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings.
That's right. That's right. Attaboy, Clarence.
And you'll find more on all of Janine's DVD picks at our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. In for Robin Young, it's Here and Now. Despite boasting the world's third largest oil reserves behind only Saudi Arabia and Iran, Iraqis wait in long lines to buy gas for their cars. That is, if there's any left by the time they get to the pumps. Nearly 4 years after the war began, Iraqi oil production is barely above pre-war levels. And sabotage, oil theft, and corruption are costing the country millions of dollars. The bitter sectarian and ethnic divisions blamed for the surging violence in Iraq have also prevented agreement on an Iraqi oil law, which would help settle how the country handles billions of dollars in oil revenues. The violence also creates a huge obstacle to investment in Iraq's oil industry by major international oil companies. For more on this issue, we turn to James Plack. He's a senior oil analyst with Cambridge Energy Research Associates, and he was an advisor to the Iraq Study Group. Welcome.
Thank you, Deborah.
Can you explain what's happening with Iraq's oil industry right now? What's the situation like?
Essentially, it's stagnant. And in the oil industry, stagnation means decline because the security situation just will not permit normal field operations. And without such operations, you not only don't increase production, it actually declines over time. Anything really on the economic side has been adversely affected by a lack of security.
So I would imagine that that means that in order for it to improve, you would hope that there might be some investments from firms. However, the deteriorating security situation would make that unlikely or certainly not attractive. So that's got to be a big issue.
That's very, very true. The most difficult problem for the Iraqis to address is how to distribute the oil revenue because the Constitution smudges that distinction. Previously, all revenue had gone into the central government. Under the current constitution, that may not be the case. And without a greater degree of legal certainty and the possibility of enforcing contracts and so forth, I think investors, particularly the large international oil companies, would be very hesitant about going into Iraq.
You know, we've been hearing from some U.S. lawmakers about an Iraq oil law, specifically Senators Hillary Clinton and John Ensign. They wrote in the Wall Street Journal, in fact, that there needs to be an Iraq oil trust, which they say is modeled after the Alaskan Permanent Fund. And I guess that trust would guarantee that every Iraqi would have a share in the oil revenues. Do you think that's a good idea?
It's an interesting idea. I don't think it's practical at the present time for one very simple reason. Without current census data, that kind of distribution simply isn't possible.
What would be a better way to make sure maybe that Iraqis feel that they have more of a stake in this?
I think one mistake that the United States has made in Iraq fairly consistently and in a number of areas that have contributed to the present situation is going in and changing things, remodeling things the way we think they ought to be. Mm. Iraq had a functioning government and society under Saddam Hussein, who was one of the worst dictators of the 20th century. It was distorted and it got progressively worse, beginning really with the invasion of Kuwait in 1990. But through the 70s and even through much of the 80s, until the Iran-Iraq War took center stage, Iraq had a reasonably efficient system. I would think as a starting point, rather than trying to reinvent it all along our lines, not Iraqi lines, we might well go back to what once worked.
And what was that?
Simply oil revenues went into the treasury and funded the national budget. Iraq, after the revolution in 1958, had adopted a Eastern European-style socialist economy. I wouldn't recommend that, and I think that's something that Iraq will itself move away from. But as a starting point to essentially leave the revenues in the hands of an effective and functioning central government, and I would say it's debatable whether that exists.
Well, right. I mean, isn't that the problem?
Well, there are a lot of problems to be resolved first. I would say security, an effective government, effective administration within the ministries, certainly including the oil ministry, dealing with corruption. About 200,000 barrels a day, we estimate, of Iraqi crude oil are stolen.
Stolen.
So there are innumerable problems that need to be fixed.
What does this mean in terms of the supply within Iraq?
Well, Iraq has not been able to repair its refinery system since the United States bombed it in 1991 during the first Gulf War and the liberation of Kuwait. There's half of the Basra refinery, for example, that's never functioned again. The largest refinery, which is at Beji between Baghdad and Kirkuk, is designed to process mostly northern Iraqi crude oil, which is a little bit different from southern, and by itself would be able to supply about two-thirds of Iraq's requirements. And there's other smaller refineries, including the one at Basra to which I referred, that would fill in the remainder of a consumption of about 500,000 barrels a day. But like most places in the world, the greatest portion of petroleum products are in the form of transportation fuels, gasoline, diesel, even jet fuel today. And those refineries have been damaged in a way that reduces their ability to make those kinds of products. So they supplement their domestic production, which is well below the design capacity of the refineries, with imports of about 150,000 barrels a day petroleum products from Iran and Kuwait.
So basically what you're saying then is even if there is quite a bit of oil in Iraq, there's not enough gasoline in Iraq.
Yes, that's right. There are very long gas lines. It's not uncommon for those who are trying to fuel their vehicles who are not buying on the black market, which many do, to have to sit in a gas line for half a day and sometimes out of gasoline once you finally get to the pump. And even more important in some respects than gasoline, especially at this time of the year, is heating fuels. Kerosene is widely used as a heating fuel, as is liquefied petroleum gas or propane. And both of those also are in tight supply.
How crucial is Iraqi oil for the United States? You know, there are many folks who are of the thinking that a big part of the reason that we went to war in Iraq in the first place was because of the country's oil supply. Is it very important?
If we didn't have the amount of crude oil that Iraq is exporting today, which runs around 1.3 million barrels a day, if that amount were eliminated, then we would be back to a situation that we were in a year ago, where there would be almost no spare production capacity in the world, and prices, of course, would rise accordingly.
Because of all of these problems, would you say that you're not optimistic about the future of the Iraqi oil industry?
The best way to approach it is simply to put the Iraqi oil industry on hold, because there's very little that can be done under present circumstances. The political resolution that is necessary for the various factions, the Kurds, the Shia, and the Sunni, to come together in Iraq and resolve their quite stark differences and begin to a process of reconciliation, which is what the U.S. government is seeking to promote. And the government of Prime Minister Maliki is also actively engaged in trying to bring that about. That's really what's critical. Then you can address the security problem, then you can begin to address investment, and then you can begin to expand oil production, which would be to everyone's benefit.
James Plack is a senior oil analyst with Cambridge Energy Research Associates. Still to come, a trip to Kenya to find out why the country produces so many world-class distance runners. You're listening to Here and Now. The sun is out in Denver, but after 2 days of heavy snow, the city is just getting back to business. Denver's International Airport is reopening today after being shut down since Wednesday, and this has created chaos for thousands of travelers around the country. Marty McGurk is one of them. He's from Denver, but on business in Phoenix right now. He was supposed to fly back through Denver today, then catch a flight to Boston, where he and his family spend the holidays. But now it seems he's stuck. Welcome, Marty.
Hello.
We understand that right now we're talking with you on your cell phone because on a landline you're on hold with United Airlines trying to rebook your flight.
That's correct. I called this morning after receiving an automated call saying that my flight had been changed. When I called, the automated system said, you know, your wait time will be approximately 100 minutes. I've actually been on hold for about 40 minutes, so I'm chewing my way through the line, but I still have a good 40 minutes to wait, I'm afraid.
So when you left Denver, right, you left Denver earlier this week to go to Phoenix first on business.
Correct.
And what happened?
I had an early flight, and as I got up, it was about 4:30. There wasn't a flake on the ground, and they'd been calling for snow, and literally, as I'm walking out the door, it was like someone turned on the Hollywood snow machine. By the time I got on the plane, about 40 minutes later, there was an inch on the tarmac, and it was blowing sideways, and I pretty quickly realized that I was going to have trouble getting back.
So your wife, right, and your one-year-old son, they're on the East Coast waiting for you for the holidays?
Yeah, they're up in New Hampshire, anxiously awaiting my arrival.
So when do you think you're going to make it out?
I haven't actually talked to a human yet, so I have no idea. So that's what I'm trying to figure out today. My flight from Phoenix to Denver is supposed to be at 7 p.m., so I thought I should have no problem, but it's looking like that's not going to be the case.
So where would you spend the holidays?
Oh, I'm going to spend the holidays in Boston. You know, one way or the other, I'm going to get back to New England. So,
Marty McGurk, one of thousands of travelers trying to rebook a flight today after this week's blizzard in Denver. Marty, good luck. We hope you make it back in time for the holidays.
Thank you very much.
This is also a busy time of year for retailers. Joining me now is Amelia Nidell. She's the owner of the Red Carpet Baby Store in Denver. She's on the line from her home in Littleton, Colorado. She closed her store Wednesday because of the snow. And Amelia, the message on your store's phone directs customers to call your cell phone. Are you hearing from any of them?
A little bit. I did. I got one call about one $15 item.
That's it?
I've had a couple other people call me about products and things like that. I don't know how many sales I've actually done sitting here at home.
Do you think you're going to be able to get in today?
Yeah, I think so. We do have a four-wheel drive, and my husband was busy out shoveling our cars yesterday, and we're fairly close to a main street that's been plowed. So I do hope to get in this afternoon. And I have an eight-month-old baby, too. So that the first consideration will be, you know, what's best for him. But we will try to get in. Hopefully shopping can resume.
How important is this time of year for your business?
Well, it is very important. I mean, it's kind of the only time of year when you're guaranteed to do really well. Other than that, you know, you just kind of have to go with the flow. And the first quarter can be so slow after the holidays, you know, that you really kind of want to do as much business as you can now in preparation for, you know, what happens in January, particularly, I think, in children's retail, because in any business, I think it gets slow. But, you know, with kids, you do so much for them in December that they kind of get forgotten about, at least for January.
So do you think you're going to be able to recover? Are you going to stay open later over the weekend or tonight if you are able to get to your store? What are you going to do to try to make up for this?
I may do some extended hours, and I'll probably do a little bit of email blasting, just asking people to please remember to come by this weekend as they do get more out and about. And I'll probably run some sales. I have some holiday items, like art easels and little grand pianos that are sort of bigger items that I'll probably run some sales on, or maybe even all toys. You know, I'll probably do a really good sale to try to get people. And then luckily, my little strip of shopping is right in a residential area. So I think if nothing else, we're going to get people who are a little stir-crazy at home and walking around. So hopefully we can go out there and try to pull them in and tell them to go home and at least grab their credit card.
All right. Well, good luck.
Thank you so much.
Amelia Nidell is the owner of the Red Carpet Baby in Denver. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. In the world of elite athletes, certain countries seem to dominate certain sports. For table tennis champs, look to China. Want to find some of the best players in soccer? Look to Brazil. And as for long-distance running, well, Kenyan women have won 6 out of the last 10 Boston Marathons, and Kenyan men have won 8 out of the last 10 Victor's Laurel wreaths. What's the secret to their success? Here and Now's Karen Given went to E10 Kenya to find out more. Goats graze on the infield of Kamarni Showgrounds in E10, Kenya, elevation 8,000 feet. It's 10:30 on a Tuesday morning, and the track is full of runners doing speed work. The stadium isn't much to look at. The yellow and green paint is peeling off the concrete wall that surrounds it. Runners take shelter from the morning sun under 2 acacia trees, not under the collapsing roof of the stands. Anyone's best guess is that in this town of about 4,000 people, nearly 500 are runners. More than 200 earn their living as world-class professional athletes. The rest are struggling with no sponsor, no agent, no formal coach, and a limitless amount of hope.
We are still struggling. Maybe next year we'll be champions.
Ask any of the 60 or so runners here today, and they'll tell you they have the same dream, to be champions. Except the ones who tell you they want to win an Olympic gold medal or set a world record. It might seem like they're aiming high, but in E10, people say that when you have faith, anything is possible, especially when it comes to running.
It has an awe, maybe, about it, or a kind of a feeling that people get, you know, that this is where so many champions have come from.
Brother Colm O'Connell came from Ireland to St. Patrick's Secondary School to teach geography in 1976. He stumbled into coaching what is quite possibly the world's most successful running program. Over the years, St. Patrick's has planted a tree for every athlete who's made it big on the international stage. Rumor has it that St. Patrick's Grove has more than 100 trees. O'Connell won't confirm.
Kenyans traditionally don't count things so much. They don't even count the number of children they have. When we plant it, you will see the earlier trees are large. Because I think at the time, we didn't realize we'd have so many athletes.
St. Patrick's didn't start out to be a running school and still admits students solely on the basis of academics, never athletics. In fact, even Brother Colm knew nothing about running when he came to attend. But St. Patrick's success could not be derailed by the likes of an amateur coach.
The athletes kept coming. The success kept coming. So we had to keep planting more and more trees. And eventually, we're going to end up with a forest here in our front garden.
So now you're planting bushes.
We're down to shrubs now. I don't know, maybe there'll be flowers next. If they get any more crowded.
Brother Colm lives in a quiet little house on the grounds of St. Patrick's. He focuses now on training 3 professional athletes who also live there and entertaining foreign coaches who come to learn his secrets. But O'Connell says there are no secrets.
People look for reasons as to why they're so good. So they talk about altitude and they talk about diet and they talk about even genetics and they talk about lifestyle. But very few people ever talk about the way they train. You know, they tend to ignore the fact that they train incredibly hard. Maybe in the Western world, sometimes we would prefer if there was another reason other than training.
Good morning.
Good morning. Karibu sana.
Have you left?
It's 2 hours before sunrise when I climb into the back of world record holder Lorna Kiplagat's covered truck, driven by her husband, Peter Langerhorst, to witness for myself the Kenyan commitment to training. After about an hour and a half, Peter turns the truck down a rocky mining trail, and our ears pop as we descend. At the bottom, Peter offers a little advice to Lorna and the junior runners she's brought along.
2 weeks ago, we had somebody with a complete blackout. I don't say who, but he was like, I don't see the road anymore. He was completely lost. So take it easy, okay?
For the next hour and 47 minutes, the athletes run uphill from the Flossper Mine. At an average grade of 7%, they climb 4,000 feet over 13 miles, the distance of a half marathon. Kids and adults alike come out of their homes to watch Lorna go by.
It's often known that people who are training there, they are big names, they are big champions, they are Olympic champions, and somebody would think, oh, that's so-and-so, I think it is so-and-so, even if they don't know, if it, oh, I think I saw Lorna, I think it was Catherine. That's like the highlights of the day for the kids also. So people love running in Kenya. They really have respect, you know, when you pass by as an athlete, people really, you motivate people.
Lorna whiles away an afternoon sitting on a mattress on the ground of her high-altitude training center, chatting and laughing with friends and family, seemingly unaware that the clock is ticking to her next training session. Peter Langerhorst sits under the shade of a large umbrella, reading his paper. To hear him tell the story, all this lightheartedness belies a very serious truth about runners in Kenya.
The difference is, in the U.S. and in Europe, we have so many opportunities. We have a lot of chances. If we can study, we can work, we can even decide to do nothing, especially in Europe, but not in Africa. You don't have chances, you don't have opportunities. So there are no choices. It's a way to get out, absolutely.
And to get out, Kenyan runners don't even have to win. In a country where the average annual income is $460, athletes can earn as much as $10,000 every 2 weeks during the marathon season by losing races, working as pace setters for elite runners.
You can do a whole host of things with $10,000.
University of Georgia professor of physical education and sports science Rose Chipyater Thompson knows what it's like to be motivated by poverty. If it wasn't for running, she'd still be living in a small village near Iten.
With $10,000, that is 800,000 Kenya shillings, you can build a house, you can buy a farm, you can send all your siblings to school, you can build a house for your parents.
When Professor Chipyater Thompson came to the University of Madison, Wisconsin in 1979, she was so worried about losing her track scholarship that she'd sneak in an extra training session every morning at 11.
So we have extra pressures. Anybody, any human being, if you're pressured to do something, if the door is locked, you have no choice but to find a window. And that window is running. You work so hard, train so hard, so when somebody sees you running, they think it's magic. You fool them.
But it's not magic.
It's not magic.
It might not be magic, but for those who are convinced that the secret is more than just altitude, attitude, poverty, and a lot of hard work, Professor Chipyater Thompson offers a simple solution.
Go to Kenya. Stay there. Live there. Move your family there. You see tennis families moving to Florida, where it's warm. Well, move your child to Kenya. You always welcome people. We welcome you anytime.
Our report on the runners of Kenya came to us from Here and Now's Karen Given. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Have a great weekend. Enjoy the holidays. And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.